This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with local disability advocate Barbara Pritchard and Fran Tobin, an organizer for the Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition, IRRC. But first, disability news for the week of April 26, 2021. A panel of federal officials, advocates, and other stakeholders is supposed to set the government's autism priorities, but new research suggests that's not what's happening. The long-running Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee advises the Secretary of Health and Human Services and coordinates federal activities related to autism. They regularly update a strategic plan outlining what types of autism research should be funded. But as of 2017, the committee's plan indicated that more priority should go toward research looking at treatments, interventions, evidence-based services, and lifespan issues, areas that traditionally receive limited support. But a study published recently in the journal Autism indicates that spending is not following suit. Grants for autism research between 2017 and 19 from the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. Department of Education, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the three largest government funders of such efforts, the largest portion of those funds, nearly a third, was directed toward biological research, while less than 10% went to understanding services and lifespan issues, the study found. The findings come as the status of the IACC remains in flux. The committee last met in July of 2019 before all of its members' terms expired in September of that year. To date, no new members have been appointed. Susan Daniels, director of the National Institutes of Mental Health's Office of Autism Research Coordination, which manages the IACC, said last September that her office was working to seat a new committee, but earlier this year indicated that the process was delayed by the changeover to a new administration. Now Daniels says that a new committee should be seated soon. According to Daniels, quote, "The final stages of the appointment process are underway, and we anticipate holding the first meeting of the new IACC in the summer of 2021. COVID-19 and its impact on autistic people, their families, and the autism community will be a top priority for the new committee," end quote. Members of Congress are calling on the Biden administration to support increasing supplemental security income benefits and, quote, "desperately needed improvements to the program, including increasing the asset limit and eliminating the marriage penalty, among other changes. These changes would be included as part of the American Families Plan, expected to be unveiled soon. In a letter to the president, more than 50 representatives said, quote, "People with disabilities and older adults receiving SSI represent some of the most marginalized members of our society. History will not forgive us or if we fail to address their needs in the recovery effort," end quote. The representatives suggest increasing SSI benefits to at least 100% of the federal poverty line. They also want the asset limit to increase for the first time since 1984 and for the cap to be tied to inflation. In addition, the letter says that SSI should increase the amount of money that people can earn before their benefits are reduced, and they want rules lowering benefits for those who marry or if individuals accept food or shelter from friends or family to be eliminated. SSI benefits currently go to about 8 million Americans, many of whom have disabilities. Individuals receive a maximum federal payment of less than $800 a month from the program, while couples can receive less than $1,200 a month, though some states add to those figures. To remain eligible, individuals can have no more than $2,000 in their names, and couples are limited to $3,000 in assets at any given time. The American Families Plan is expected to focus on paid family leave, child care, and other domestic issues, and serves as the second part to the $2 trillion American Jobs Plan that Biden has been promoting in recent weeks. And finally, President Joe Biden has proposed spending $400 billion over 8 years on home and community-based services for people with disabilities and those who are elderly, a major part of his $2 trillion infrastructure plan. It comes as the coronavirus pandemic has hit nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and group homes, killing more than 174,000 people and increasing awareness of the need for more long-term care options. Prospects for the proposal are uncertain. Republicans argue that much of what the proposed American Jobs Plan contains, including the emphasis on home-based care, doesn't count as real infrastructure. Advocates say the proposal doesn't address the full extent of care needed by the nation's rapidly growing older population in that middle income seniors won't qualify directly for programs that would be expanded. They would, however, benefit from a larger, better paid, better trained workforce of aides that help people in their homes, one of the plan's objectives. Services can include home medical and therapy visits, assistance with personal help for cooking, cleaning, and other chores, transportation, home repairs, and modifications. It can also help pay for a durable medical equipment such as wheelchairs or oxygen tanks. Currently, there are 53 million family members provide most of the care that vulnerable seniors and people with disabilities require without being paid, and often at significant financial and emotional cost. According to AARP, family caregivers on average devote about 24 hours a week to helping their loved ones. The sobering reality is that long-term care services are too expensive for most individuals and families. According to a survey last year by Genworth, a financial services firm, the hourly cost for a home health aide averages $24 an hour. Annually, assisted living centers charge an average of more than $50,000 a year, while nursing home care costs more than $90,000 annually. Many people assume that Medicare will pay for long-term care, including home-based services, but in reality, Medicare coverage is extremely limited. Medicaid can be an alternative, but eligibility standards are strict, and only people with incomes and assets at the poverty level qualify. According to projections, by the end of this decade, an additional 1 million workers will be needed for home-based care. A number of experts believe that will be difficult, if not impossible, to reach given poor pay and working conditions. The Biden plan still has little detail in resolving issues such as strengthening the workforce, eliminating waiting lists, and expanding services. It will also need to address the lack of accessible services in rural counties or for people with dementia. Supporters of the plan say it could just be the opening of a major effort to strengthen other parts of the safety net, including the addition of tax credits for caregivers, expanding Medicare's home health benefit, and removing the requirement that people receive Medicare home health homebound. And that's the news for this week. You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today by two guests on the phone, Barb Pritchard, who is a returning guest from a couple of weeks ago, and Fran Tobin, who is an organizer for the IRRC, the Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Why don't we start with introductions, and Fran, I'd like for you to go first, if you would, please.
Well, so thanks for having us on as part of the Fran Tobin, and I am one of the organizers with the Institutional Rescue Cult and Recovery Coalition. This was formed when it became so blatantly obvious that the death rate, the COVID death rate in congregate care settings was so extraordinary and required and called for extraordinary action, which unfortunately we didn't see. We're advocating around that. And I'm also the coordinator of the Alliance for Community Services, which is a labor community coalition working on promoting, protecting, and improving the quality of public services that meet human needs.
Yeah. Okay, great. And Barb, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, too?
I'm Barb Pritchard. I'm a local Champaign-Urbana individual that I spend a lot of time working on disability rights issues and have for a number of years. I'm retired, but doing volunteer work and advocacy is my passion. I got involved with Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition a little more than a year ago. They hosted an event called Waiting to Die, which was a Zoom event, and talked about what the conditions were for people with disabilities and seniors in nursing homes. And they had a couple of guests that were from Pennsylvania and Denver, who talked about their efforts to move people out of congregate care into a safe environment and, if possible, then back into the community. But the intent was to, on an emergency basis, move people out so that the nursing home might have a little more space for people to social distance. But all in all, an effort to save lives. And so I got involved with the coalition, which is, at that point was primarily Chicago-based. And I worked a little bit to pull some people in from the Joliet area and the Alton area and Champaign-Urbana. So we're trying to expand. I don't think locally, Vicki, we're having as many issues as some of the Chicago area nursing homes are having.
Mm-hmm.
But I know statewide, and Fran, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think of the 1% of people that are in congregate care, I believe it's upwards of 40% are dying in congregate care of the COVID vaccine.
No, not of the vaccine, of the disease, right?
I'm sorry, yes, of the disease, I apologize. Not the vaccine.
You don't scare people, Barb.
The lack of vaccine.
Yes, yes. So what actions, what does the IRRC, what are the things that you actually do to advocate for this situation to change?
Fran? Well, go ahead, Fran.
So most of the work is, you know, first looking into options, and given the disaster that COVID has been for many, many different ways, but especially in congregate settings, it's looking at what are the things that could be done. And the fact that there are groups in other parts of the country that have been doing what emergency action is usually thought of. If you have a community that's flooded, what's the first step in an emergency? The first step is to get people out of immediate danger.
Mm-hmm.
If their places are dangerous to be in, then you get them out, you find temporary housing. Nationally, FEMA is supposed to do that. FEMA has, in fact, set up various kinds of temporary housing for folks who need to get out of a place of danger. And in fact, FEMA has actually built permanent housing in a few places around the country in a disaster. So the first question is it possible to actually move people from the greatest danger? And we've seen that, yes, it absolutely is possible. But then it's the question of, okay, so how does that actually happen? What are the kind of resources and what kind of both government and private agency action is needed? So the work we've done is first identifying, you know, what some of these options are, educating ourselves, the advocacy community, and the disability community around that. But then moving to getting decision makers to move on those. So FEMA was an obstacle, even though Category B funds specifically are to provide and pay for temporary housing for people that need to be moved out of danger. Nowhere in the country did FEMA actually activate their Category B authority. They have, and they would have done if it were people not in congregate institutions that were dying at the same rate. But
What possible response could they have for not activating that?
Well, it's troubling. The general response, I think primarily these are evidence of the different aspects and how deep some of the institutional bias is that I think many of your listeners are familiar with.
Mm.
The first thing people said literally was, well, we don't want to move people out of their homes. And like, well, first of all, so these are, you know, they're called nursing homes, but they're not actually their homes. These are places that they're in order to get a certain level of kind of care. The second part is, so they're care homes, long-term care facilities. So therefore, it must be the safest place they could be. Well, maybe in some other situation, but in a pandemic, when shelter in place doesn't work because you can't actually do what sheltering in place is for other people. In a facility where two or three or four people are in a room, there's no way they can have the kind of separation and distance that reduces the spread of the virus. Places were not called petri dishes for COVID for nothing.
Right.
So I think this bias brought folks to think, oh, well, yeah, it's terrible, but, you know, they're where they're going to be taken care of. Instead of looking at the data and realizing, actually, these facilities were the most dangerous places people could be.
Yeah, the numbers clearly show that.
And I think then the third piece is, so there was this blindness, I think, willful, I don't know, but this blindness to the idea that it is actually possible to relocate folks. And again, there's, I think, there's this idea of, well, you know, people are in these facilities because that's the only place they could possibly be. Well, obviously, we know lots of people that have successfully transitioned into a community setting out of one of these facilities, so it's not the only place they could be. And we've seen programs in other parts of the country that did relocate people on a temporary basis, providing the kind of support, PAs and otherwise, that were needed, and all those folks are doing well.
But it was
had at least one response was the idea of saying, well, you know, old people die all the time, so what do you expect? Actually, a person said this to us.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, again, part of the bias is that in a way of blaming the victims, that this high death rate was because of the people, not the place, and not the nature of the facility.
Yeah, they were going to die anyway, so, you know, why bother?
And we did see in Illinois, if you look at a similar population that has very similar health and underlying conditions profiles, folks that do live independently through the home services program, they had about 1% infection rate. More than that percent died in facilities. So it's not the people, it's the setting.
Yeah. Have things improved at all since, you know, a lot of people who are in these settings have gotten the vaccine?
Absolutely. The vaccine rollout, of course, was lots of different problems, but absolutely. Getting the vaccines out has made a huge difference. The infection and death rate has dropped enormously, so absolutely, folks are better off having had the vaccine, though the infection rate is still higher inside these facilities than in the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have seen that many of the facilities have bopped in and out of what they've called outbreak status, so they keep changing what they can and can't do because, again, when you're in an enclosed space, if the virus gets in, it gets all over the place.
Well, but even enclosed space is kind of a misnomer because you have multiple staff members coming in and out every day who are exposing themselves to the world. So
exactly.
So anybody who comes in who gets exposed could potentially infect a lot of people because they work with a lot of people in the course of their jobs. Correct?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And they go from room to room and patient to patient, which doesn't help either.
Yeah.
And a good number of, no, I should put this, the staff haven't all gotten their vaccines. Some are not getting vaccinated. And that, I think, poses a danger to the residents. And I know from talking to a few people that have been in nursing homes, they're very nervous about this. They may not be at outbreak status today, but they don't know about tomorrow.
Yeah. Let's take away the idea of a pandemic for the moment and talk about the fact that there are people who live in nursing homes that would rather be in their own home receiving supports and services there. And so is the IRRC working only based on what's happening with the pandemic? Or are you looking a little bit more long range?
Well, the IRRC was sparked by the pandemic and was really looking to say, you know, people with disabilities and people in these facilities in any kind of emergency, this one or the next one, need to be given the same kind of emergency saving, the rescuing that anyone else would get.
Okay.
So the focus is really around the emergency response, but it's also made clear that there are fundamental problems with sort of the nature of how some of these facilities are governed and how they're held accountable, what the kind of monitoring is. This is related to that. One of the things that came out of this work that the IRRC has been doing of organizing people that are currently in facilities is for the city of Chicago, within the city limits, there is supposed to be this ombudsman program that monitors health and investigates health and safety complaints on behalf of residents. And those ombudsmen were created because of all the problems that exist in these facilities. And as you said, in a survey, about a third of people who were answered a survey said they wanted to get out of the facility immediately on an emergency basis, and three quarters said they wanted to get out of the facility at some time on a permanent basis.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, substantial numbers of people, if they had the option, a real option, you know, they would choose to be elsewhere.
So in
Chicago,
go ahead. Go ahead.
And one of the things we discovered was that the residents learned that during the pandemic, the ombudsman program for the facilities within Chicago was only half-staffed. So they literally only had half the people providing the kind of support they were supposed to have.
Oh, my gosh.
And it turns out, though, this affects primarily people in the institutions that are in the city of Chicago. It's actually a state agency that's responsible for this. So the state head of the Department of Aging had decided that she wanted the ombudsman program to be privatized, and therefore the contract that the city was using, it wasn't going to cover the future hires. So the city literally left vacant positions that would have been health and safety positions, making these facilities even more dangerous. Currently, for reasons we really can't fully understand, the Department of Aging statewide is still trying to push that. So the IRRC, with a number of elected officials, is working on turning that around, because at a minimum, these programs should be fully staffed and have the kind of public support that they deserve.
Absolutely. So the states that are doing this well, which ones are they, and what are they doing differently there than what's happening here in Illinois?
The two states that we worked closely with are Pennsylvania and Colorado. Colorado got a model where they actually work with a resident of a nursing home, and they work with somebody who's maybe been homeless. And there's a couple of programs that end up working together, and they work, and at least during the pandemic, they were housing people in hotel rooms that otherwise would have been empty.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure people were not contagious with the virus. And then after that, they'd try and move them to somewhere in the community that fit their needs. And the person who's homeless served as the personal assistant and also got lodging. And it was supervised by a couple of different agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania is doing something similar. And they've gotten very creative in how to get the funding and are doing it kind of county by county or applying for funding here and there and sort of piecemealing things together. That's why we pulled together a group on the national level to do some federal advocacy. Do you want to add anything, Fran?
Well, I think that's great, great description. And so through this network of people around the country, we've been able to have meetings with multiple members of Congress. We've engaged in developing essentially what a model could be that Congress could be funding on an ongoing basis, and have outlined with a number of other partners around the country, about 80 organizations have signed on to this proposal that also would have FEMA retool how they operate in an emergency. So that's some of the advocacy that we're doing as well.
It seems to me that that FEMA has been the object of derision almost every time there is any kind of an emergency when it comes to how they serve people with disabilities. So it seems like an ongoing issue as far as I know.
Yes,
absolutely. You know, you may remember a while ago now, but Hurricane Katrina,
mm-hmm.
It was a disaster in many ways, and many people with disabilities were left inside facilities as there was a flood. It wasn't a pandemic, it was a flood. So you'd think it would be a little more obvious, and some of those folks were left there to die. And coming out of that, the Federal Department of Transportation actually issued guidance to all states to say every state should make some kind of plan for how you deal with people in congregate facilities during some kind of disaster. And needless to say, hardly any state did.
Seems that the Biden administration is putting more focus, you know, given at least the news for this week, more focus on community-based care and, you know, increasing resources for that kind of care. Does that give you any hope? And what kind of advocacy do you suggest our listeners take part in to help make those things happen?
It's absolutely a good sign that the Biden administration is pushing for more resources in that direction. You know, our coalition and Barb and others have long been pushing for more support and more resources, but also more personnel with more and better training, with more and better wages. You know, people who are personal attendants and caregivers need also to be, you know, fairly paid, which most aren't, and get the kind of support and training that they need. So it's absolutely a good step that the Biden administration is shifting that direction. And I think we need to continue to promote, you know, making that actually happen, but also that as it translates into the local, ultimately, you know, people live in particular communities and in particular facilities. When it gets into the local level, we need to make sure that, that those federal directives and the federal leanings and guidance translated into good policy on the ground.
One last question for you. Well, I do want you to give any contact information if you have a website or whatever, but one more question before we go to that is that a lot of people who are in a situation where they have elderly parents or family members who have disabilities, they really don't know other options. How do we change that? You know, I have an elderly parent and all I know is nursing home.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's sort of been put out there as the thing one does rather than one piece of a much bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
That the federal shift in that will make a big difference. But I think we also have to do a better job educating folks in general about the options.
And I suppose I suppose more people who do that, who find alternatives to nursing homes, the more options people will see and they'll grow and so forth. So is there a website that people can go to, Fran, to learn more about the IRRC?
The best source is probably Facebook. There's a Facebook page.
I think we lost Barb.
IRR Coalition.
What was that again?
So the IRR Coalition on Facebook, the best way to get more information and also make comments about some of their...
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Barb Pritchard and Fran Tobin of the IRRC. Thank you very much.